BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Sunday. We'll be looking ahead to the role of Catholics in next week's climate change meeting in Madrid. We hear the poignant story of a couple whose life was transformed when a child entered their life.
We're going to sled down the hill.
And it's going to be your first sled ride?
Yeah.
Okay. And... Yeah. You did it. How was that? Did you like it?
Can I do it again?
And how police are teaming up with faith groups.
Nowadays, it's often a police that will come to us to say, we're desperate for street angels in this town. Do you think you can contact some of the churches there, work with the churches in order to get street angels operating?
The terror attack on Friday has sent renewed shockwaves into the local community around London Bridge. For many, the sight of the knife-wielding attacker has brought back painful memories of events in June 2017. Then, 8 were killed and many more injured by terrorists ploughing a van into pedestrians on the bridge before they launched knife attacks in nearby Borough Market. This weekend, a spiritual focal point for the area has again been Southwark Cathedral, and the Dean of Southwark, the Very Reverend Andrew Nunn, finds himself dealing with the aftermath of another terrorist incident. He's on the line now from the Cathedral. Good morning, Dean.
Good morning.
Tell us what's been going on at the Cathedral since Friday.
Well, on Friday when the attack was taken place, we were locked down in the cathedral, then evacuated. And being out on the streets with members of the local community, people from the Borough Market, traders, customers, we were talking very much about how we were feeling, the old memories being revived, as you said, wounds being reopened. Since then, the cathedral has been able to be open and receiving people, praying with people, talking to people. People just need to be able to make sense of what's happened again.
And what kind of conversations are you having? What are people saying to you?
I think there are levels of fear around now. There are people who wonder whether this is a safe place to be. This community is very strong and very close. It's a place where we've been celebrating diversity for a long time, where there's a real spirit of inclusion. But for some people, they're just wondering what the future holds. Others are enormously resilient and just wanting to get back to their daily lives. But I think what it's shown us is that healing takes a very long time, and there is a lot of work to do in order to help people to heal.
And what kind of work is that? I remember last time when there was the last attack, you talked about the challenge of finding strength in vulnerability. Do you feel that is one way forward?
Well, I think it's part of the Christian message, looking towards Christmas, this being Advent Sunday, looking towards Christmas and the way in which God makes himself vulnerable in a little child, placing himself into our hands in that way. I think vulnerability is something that we are able to speak about. We're also able, though, to speak about hope, and that's a real strong theme in this season. And that's really today what we're going to be talking about. We've had teams of skilled listeners here, and street pastors are going to be out and about helping people during the week. I think many people just need to talk, and we want to give them an opportunity to talk and then pray with them if that's what they want.
And are people finding it harder this time round because it's happened before? Is it sort of harder to get over something when it happens the second time?
I think it is, really. I think for myself, faced with a crowd of people running away from the cathedral and the market area and wondering what on earth was going on, and that sense of deja vu, and then realizing that deja vu passes very quickly, and in fact this was reality again. I think what it's revealed to me is that the second time round can really, really hurt. So I think that's what people are finding at the moment. We'll be sort of alongside them in that, but I think the cathedral community is also feeling it as much as residents.
And as you mentioned, I mean, this is the start of Advent. It's meant to be a sort of uplifting time. I imagine it's quite hard to sort of create that kind of atmosphere at the moment.
Yes, it is uplifting time. It's also a very reflective time, I think. It's one of the seasons of the church's year that really gets overlooked because of the creep of Christmas, if I may describe it like that. And so the strong Advent themes of looking towards the kingdom, being watchers, alert to what's happening, I think those are things that we can actually talk about and then help people to look forward to Christmas, because we need to, and we will particularly need to in this community. But our hearts have gone out to Jack Merritt, the other person who was killed, the injured, and huge admiration for the acts of heroism that took place on the bridge. Absolutely amazing, self-giving.
Thank you very much, Reverend Andrew Nunn from Southwark Cathedral. Well, we'll have more on the terrorist attack later in the programme. The warnings by climate change scientists are starker than ever. The latest, that we may have already reached an irreversible tipping point in global temperature rises, creating a planetary emergency and an existential threat for humanity. Next week is the start of COP25, the 25th of the UN's annual climate gatherings, this time in Madrid. It's the last before the big climate summit in Glasgow next year. Neil Thorns, Director of Advocacy and Communications at CAFOD and Chair of the Climate Coalition, will be attending, and he joins me now from Brighton. So, Neil Thorns, with the warnings so urgent, what will COP25 be trying to do?
Well, what we hope it will do is it will achieve some action. As you say, there is next year the Paris Agreement comes into force, which was agreed in 2015. And as one of those things that governments agreed to do is that they would come back with enhanced ambitious plans. So the Paris Agreement builds from national country plans and up. And so those national country plans have to match the science, just as you say. The scientists have been absolutely clear. We can see the weather events going on around the world, and we can see the impact on poor communities around in the places where CAFOD works. So really, governments have to come away from COP25 with an ambition of coming back into COP26 with ambitious plans which match the science and match the impact which we're already seeing around our world.
Do you really feel, though, that with the scientists saying that we've now reached a tipping point, that these summits are really effective?
It's a very good question. And I think one thing that we know is that, you know, climate change, climate emergencies, it's a collective problem. You can't deal with it on a national level. And certainly as Catholics, you know, this whole sense of coming together to sort out a problem collectively is really important. That's one of the things that Pope Francis continually emphasizes. So actually, if you have to come together in these spaces, and you have to keep that sense of collectivism coming towards, because that's the only way that we're going to solve these problems.
And the big super summit is in 2020, next year, here in the UK. What has the Catholic Church itself planned?
Well, 2020 has the climate talks coming to the UK, but it also has a whole number of different international meetings happening. For example, it has the Convention on Biological Diversity happening next year. It's the fifth anniversary of the Sustainable Development Goals. And what the Catholic Church is thinking about is actually this sense of jubilee, about a restoration of Mother Earth. And that's not necessarily just about the kind of the way that you might interpret it in terms of leaving the earth to rest and restore. It's actually things about leaving fossil fuels in the ground. It's actually starting to think about, you know, why are we in the state that we're in at the minute, and what do we need to change both in the economic and social lives, but in our own personal lives as well. So I think 2020 will set us up for that decade, if you like, of how do we restore Mother Earth, but how do we do all of those things in an integrated way?
But that requires a quite a big mindset. Do you think the Catholic Church has something particular to say about that? I mean, it implies people need to look again at the ideas of competition, economic growth and so on.
Absolutely. And I think I would urge anyone who wants to kind of understand it. Pope Francis's encyclical, his letter to the world in 2015, Laudato Si, very clearly states this. He says you can't distinguish between the crisis that we're facing in nature, or the crisis we're facing in the climate, or the crisis we're facing with poverty. All of those things are at crisis point. They are all interlinked, and we need to deal with the root causes of them, which, as you say, it's about how do you redefine progress? What is it that we actually want to do, both in our personal lives, in the way that we live, but also that we want our governments to do? And I think that's really important for us to make sure that we are combining those two things in terms of expressing it personally, but also expressing it to our governments that we want action, and we want action now and urgently.
And are you going to be sort of campaigning with groups on the ground to try and bring a change of mentality?
Yes, I mean, we hope certainly in the COP next, I'll be going in the second week. There's always a strong kind of civil society presence, and that's not just from the north, but that's from southern countries who are most affected, when you get the small island states people really saying, you know, this is my homeland, which is being washed away. You know, we need that action. And I think building into next year, there will be a series of events where we hope that people will be able to express just that they are, as they already are doing, in terms of what they want governments to do, and making sure that the UK can play a really leading role next year. You know, we've committed to a net zero target of 2050. If we put those credible plans in place, the UK can really play a strong role in making this 2020 a really important year and building for the decade ahead.
Neil Thorns, thanks very much. Now, we've been running a series of features called Tackling Taboos in the Arab World. This week, we're looking at unmarried mothers and their children in Morocco. It's estimated that more than 30,000 unmarried women give birth in Morocco every year. A lack of sex education combined with restrictive laws on abortion mean ever more women are joining these ranks. Reporter Shireen Elfeki has been to a pioneering organisation called Solidarité Féminine in Casablanca, which is helping this vulnerable group.
To begin with, I didn't know that I was pregnant until I was 5 weeks into it. I went back to the doctor. The first thing I asked him was, I want to lose the baby. I want to abort it. As soon as he did the ultrasound, he said, it's impossible. He said, your baby has hands and feet. I can't kill it.
Hadia is from a small town in rural Morocco. She was in her early 20s when she became pregnant with Noor, her daughter, after a brief relationship outside of marriage. When her family learned Hadia was expecting, they threw her out. She ended up giving birth alone and afraid in Casablanca, 600 kilometers from her family home.
I only speak to my mother and my aunt now. To the rest of my family, they consider me dead. I don't exist. The father of my daughter didn't accept this. He wasn't talking to me or answering my calls because he thought I was lying. He did not want to recognize her or regulate her documents or anything. A person who abandons his children, I don't consider him to be a human being.
Aisha Chenna has devoted her career to helping women like Hadia. Herself the daughter of a single parent, Aisha's interest in unmarried mothers began when she was working as a nurse.
I had just returned to work from having a baby myself, and I witnessed a single mother crying to a social worker. She told the social worker, I'm in the street. My parents have kicked me out of the house. Take your illegitimate child, they said. Throw him away. Eat him. Do whatever you want with him, but don't come back with him. That night, I didn't sleep. I swore I would never let such a scene play out again.
In 1985, Aisha set up Solidarité Féminine to help unmarried mothers rebuild their lives, learn a trade, get a job, find a place to live, as well as reconcile with their families and, critically, keep their kids. The biggest challenge, however, is helping these women gain a sense of self-esteem.
Don't tell me you're a single mother. You're a mother. I am a woman, and I should be responsible for myself, and I should not ask for help. I don't need anyone, and I will live with dignity. When they get used to this, they leave here with self-confidence, and thanks to God, they will find their way.
For Hadia, Solidarité Féminine has been a lifeline.
It's a beautiful feeling when one holds a daughter or son in her hands, when she's so small and she looks at me not knowing anything. The most important thing is that my baby is safe here and is well fed.
Aisha is a reformer, not a radical, which in part explains why her approach is taking hold in Morocco's conservative communities. Her message to a new generation of women is one of sexual caution rather than sexual freedom.
Today we see women in high school or at university becoming single mothers. That's why when I go to university, I tell them, "Look, my girl, he's going to promise you marriage, but if you get pregnant, he's going to run away and leave you alone with your child."
In Arabic, the term for illegitimate child is Ibn Haram, son of the forbidden. Aisha categorically rejects hardline religious attitudes towards children born out of wedlock, as well as accusations by religious conservatives of undermining so-called traditional values.
At one point, I was judged by extremists that I was encouraging corruption and that I was bringing in Western ideas, etc. Today, when they come to me, they say, "Forgive us. We did not understand you before. That's enough for me."
With attitudes slowly changing, Hadia is also optimistic about the future.
I can see that the new generation is progressing and more accepting of single mothers. I think this will happen in my daughter's generation. I want her to have everything I was deprived of, and God willing, she will have a bright future. This is what I want to have in the coming years. I want a good life for my daughter, one which is better than mine, God willing.
Hadia ending that report by Shireen Elfeki. Faith groups often work on the front line of social problems like homelessness, drug addiction and delinquency. Their work overlaps with the problems the police are dealing with, but often there isn't much coordination between the two. An organisation launched last year called Faith and Policing Together is aiming to improve the partnership. In a moment we're going to hear about their new proposals, but first here's an example of one organisation working on the streets. Paul Blakey is the CEO of Christian Nightlife Initiative.
Street Angels was started in Halifax back in 2005. Just been safe people in and amongst the madness and chaos usually of a town centre at night. First of all, we're a visible presence, so we're usually dressed in high-vis uniforms so that people can easily identify us. So if we see somebody who's vulnerable, we'll go over and check that they're okay. We offer first aid, directions, we'll chat to people, we'll take time to listen to people if they're in situations where they're not feeling too good about themselves. So when we were first investigating launching a response to the nighttime economy of Halifax, we spoke to then the police sergeant and police inspector. They understood that what the church does works, and they were desperate for that in Halifax Town Centre. So what we do is very much in partnership with the police. On the ground, we'll be out and about at the same time as the police officers. But also, if the police come across somebody sat on a bench and just needs an hour or so to sober up, the police will come and ask for our help and we'll go and sit with them. So that frees up the police to do what they should be doing. Within the first 12 months in Halifax Town Centre, violent crime, which normally increases on a Friday, Saturday night, reduced by 42%. And that kind of became a benchmark for the police nationally. Nowadays, it's often a police that will come to us to say, "We're desperate for street angels in this town. Do you think you can contact some of the churches there, work with the churches in order to get street angels operating?"
Paul Blakey, just one example of a faith-based group working alongside the police. Well, I can speak now to Acting Inspector Marie Reevey, National Lead for Faith and Police Together and Chair of the Christian Police Association. You have a new report. What are you now proposing?
So, yes, this report is the Faith Community's Guide to Engaging with Police. And within it, I talk about lots of different ways faith communities can engage with the police and partner together to help tackle some of the bigger issues of society, particularly around addiction, serious youth violence, loneliness and homelessness. But there's other aspects in it as well. And the level of work that the churches and faith communities are doing across the UK is phenomenal, and what we'd like to see is better partnership working between the police, other statutory agencies and our faith communities to really make a significant difference in the communities that we live and work in.
So are the police more keen because there's a shortage of manpower, basically?
No, I don't think so. I think it's, obviously we are reduced in numbers, but there's a recognition now that partnership working is key. You know, we're never going to arrest our way out of the problem of addiction. What we need to do is work together to find solutions that are going to help to tackle the issue in a way that's not just law enforcement. And the police can't do that by themselves. But actually, if we work together with other statutory agencies and voluntary agencies and the faith communities, we can really see a difference happen.
And are we talking mainly about Christian groups working with the police?
No, this is a multi-faith initiative for all faiths to get involved if they want to. I'd hope that they would. But a lot of the examples in the guide are Christian examples because that's where I was able to find the evidence for the specific things that I was looking for within the work that I was doing.
Are there any difficulties to this, though? I mean, are some people perhaps put off by the idea of a faith group helping them?
I think some might be, and that could be, that's up to them. If they don't want to get the help and support of a faith group that is offering a service, then they don't have to take it. But actually, faith groups give many, many hours a week, a month and a year to serving their communities and making a real difference. And that's the key part of this. It's saying those hours that you want to volunteer, the way you want to serve your community, let's make that the most effective use we can. Those that don't want to engage, they don't have to engage, but what an opportunity, what a service for the community that can be provided.
And are you at all concerned about proselytising while this help is being delivered?
No, I'm not. Every faith has that common denominator across all faiths that they love God, however they perceive God to be, and they want to live out that love for God by serving people, serving their communities and making a difference. And it's not about a recruitment campaign. It's about actively living out the faith that they have.
Marie Reevy, thanks very much. Well, the time is just after 7:30. Later, we'll hear more on the London Bridge attacker. Every year in the run-up to the outbreak of the American Civil War, the abolitionist John Jay would attend the convention of the New York Diocese to table resolutions against the evils of slavery. And every year, a walkout by those with vested interests in the slave trade meant they were never debated. But earlier this month, the convention finally passed Jay's resolutions and set up a $1 million slavery reparations fund as part of the church's attempt to deal with its legacy. Rosie Dawson reports.
Built in 1799 on the site of a Dutch Reformed chapel, the Church of St Mark's in the Bowery incorporates the family vault of Petrus Stuyvesant, who died in 1672. Stuyvesant, according to an inscription here, was late Captain General and Governor of Amsterdam in New Netherlands, now known as New York. He was the largest landowner in Manhattan and a slave owner. The congregation here has been looking into how the New York Diocese benefited from the slave trade. Their lives and their worship are being changed by what they have found. Cynthia Copeland is co-chair of the New York Diocese Reparations Committee.
I think the work we're doing is so important because it's just a time where people are trying to reckon with the past. And, you know, we take 3 steps forward and 5 steps back and we have to start again. But within that discussion, within that process is reparations.
I mean, I was really struck in the liturgy, you know, the prayer acknowledging the part that white supremacy has played in this country. That's got to be unusual, hasn't it?
Very unusual, and even unusual for St. Mark's Church in the Bowery, of which I'm a member. Even those who are comfortable with the language are still challenged because we're just wrestling with original sin.
Bishop Andy Dietschy told this month's convention that the Diocese of New York played a significant and genuinely evil part in American slavery, with some churches owning slaves as parish servants or property assets. This involvement, he says, has come as a shock to many.
Most people think of slavery as entirely a Southern matter. I think many people would be surprised to find out the extent of slavery in New York State. Right before the beginning of the Civil War in 1860, the London Times published an article in which they said that the port of New York was the largest slave market in the world. Now, slavery itself had been eliminated in New York a couple of decades earlier with the passage of the manumission laws. But what was happening is that New York ships were bringing slaves from Africa to New York, where they were being sold to traders who took them south. And it was the driving force of the New York economy.
Father Nathaniel St-Pierre is priest at St. Augustine's Church on New York's east side. Originally, the church was known as Free Church because there was no pew rental. But for many of those who came here every week, it was anything but.
The church was an accomplice. The proof is such a design in the architecture, you know, the layout show how prepared we were to perpetuate those behaviors of disconnecting people from one another, isolate them even in coming into a sacred space to worship one God.
The church has separate entrances, originally intended to keep slaves and their masters apart. A narrow spiral staircase leads up from the organ gallery to two hidden rooms. Today you can stand in them and look down onto the church, but they used to be sealed, meaning that the slaves inside could not be seen or heard by the congregation worshipping below.
This gallery I love a lot because I feel that it is the gallery that helps us more understand the reality of things. If you looked at the walls, you will see the footprint of benches, small benches, on that side and on that side. Those were the small benches that were pews for the slaves to sit on.
Were they forced to come to church, you suppose?
I think it's not really the force that is interesting, it's the concept behind it. They were to church to serve their master, not to worship. So they were there to be useful to their masters, taking care of the kids, drive the carriage, operate the boats. So they happened to be in church at the same times with those slave masters' family, but they were not here really for worship. You know, personally, I don't think I was attracted to St. Augustine's when they were looking for a priest for any other reason. The day that I visited and I heard of the history of the slave galleries, I was suddenly attracted, and I wanted to be there to be able to understand the experience and also retell the story.
The Diocese Slavery Awareness Programme has involved a year of lamentation and a year of apology. Now is the year of reparation. The church's conversation is taking place in the context of the race for the Democratic nomination for the White House, with several of the candidates saying they support the principle of national reparations for slavery. So I asked Bishop Andy Deitchy whether the church is leading by example.
There are people who want to be president of the United States who are talking about reparations, and this is a good thing for us as a people. Where it will go for us as a society, I don't know. It may be that as a church, we're a little bit ahead of the curve on those conversations. What I will say is that what we are doing is changing the lives of people inside the church. And if people transform by the work that we're doing in these areas, then we may be making a difference, which is hard to quantify, but which is really how the church exercises the gospel in the world anyway, which is through the lives and witnesses of ordinary people.
Bishop Andy Deitchy ending that report by Rosie Dawson. The author Mitch Albom is known for his books, including The Five People You Meet in Heaven. Following the devastating earthquake in Haiti 9 years ago, Mitch met a pastor who was distraught that the orphanage he ran there had been destroyed. Mitch flew a gang of volunteers to help the pastor with the rebuild, and he ended up being asked to take over the running of the orphanage. Mitch Albom's latest book, Finding Chica, is the story of one extraordinary girl who arrived at the orphanage and the impact her short life had on Mitch and his wife, Janine.
Chica was born 3 days before the earthquake, survived the earthquake miraculously when the house that she was sleeping in with her mother collapsed around them. They were just left, you know, naked to the sky, but alive. And 2 years later, her mother died in that same rebuilt cinder block house, giving birth to a baby brother because there was no doctor present and something went wrong. And the baby was born and the mother died in the same bed. And Chica was brought to our orphanage. And when she first arrived, she was very, very bossy and very, very loud. And then when she was 5 years old, everything took a turn.
Well, that was the moment, wasn't it, when you went to have an MRI scan and there was a terrible discovery.
Yeah. Well, her face had started drooping. We finally found a neurologist, which is not easy, and there was only one MRI machine in the entire country of Haiti. So that wasn't easy either, and you had to bring $750 cash and sit there at 4 o'clock in the morning and wait to get a picture taken. And finally, when the picture came back with the report was only two sentences. It said, there's a mass on this child's brain, and whatever it is, there's no one in Haiti who can help her. And so we didn't have a whole lot of choice at that point.
So at that point, you decided to sort of take her on, almost foster her, as it were, rather and take her back to the United States.
Well, to be honest, I thought that American medicine would cure her. You know, well, we just thought, well, this is Haitian medicine's not understanding what it is, but they'll take care of it in America. And they did exploratory brain surgery, but they were hopeful that they'd be able to get everything out. And then a couple of days later, we were called into a consultation room thinking, all right, they'll tell us this will be 4 months, 2 months, 3 months, whatever. And they basically told us that she had something that was called DIPG, diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, and that she would be likely dead within 4 months. And that was a pretty horrific hour in the consultation room. And we went from thinking she was going home to being told that she could die on our watch. And they basically said to us, take her home to Haiti and just let her play, and she'll be debilitated by this in short time. But I knew how tough she was, and I knew what she had already endured. On the third day of her life, she was sleeping in the dirt of Haiti outside in the sugarcane fields, and she slept there for the first 6-7 weeks of her existence. So I looked at them, and I said, no, I'm not taking her home to die. I'm not going to give up on her. If she fights, we're going to fight.
And so you had this long period of quite intensive medical treatment.
Yeah.
We actually got some audio of Chica when you took her sledging for the first time. Let's just hear that now.
What we're going to do?
We're going to sled down the hill.
And it's going to be your first sled ride?
Yeah.
By yourself? Are you scared?
Yeah.
But you're going to do it, aren't you?
Yeah.
Because you're brave, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
You did it. How was that? Did you like it?
Can I do it again?
Gosh, that must bring back memories for you.
The thing was that she was so full of life, and right from the beginning, there was nothing sad about this experience for her. She got to come to America, and so she was going to take advantage of this. She lived 2 years. You know, we went in search of a cure, but we really found a family. And that's what Finding Chica is really about. It's not a sad book about a disease or about a little girl who dies. You know she dies on the very first page. It's about how you make a family from unlikely sources at unlikely ages, because we were in our late 50s, and that's not usually when you're starting a family.
One of the difficult moments must have been that when Chica was in Haiti, you actually discover that her father was still alive. So, in fact, she wasn't an orphan. Could he have actually taken over her care?
Not in a million years. We were told that he was dead. That is frequently something that we're told when whoever it is that's bringing us to them wants us to take the children in. I went to go see him because I wondered the same thing you just asked me. When I found him, he wasn't the slightest bit interested. He said, well, thanks for taking care of her. And I said, do you want to know about it? He said, no, you know, God will take care of it. I said, well, if she should die, is it important to you that she's buried here in Haiti? And he said, no, doesn't make a difference to me.
But there is a dilemma here, isn't there, whether orphanages in a country such as Haiti have a role. There's a charity created by J.K. Rowling, Lumos, which says that in Haiti, 30,000 children could be at home with their families if basic health and education costs were covered. Is it really right that these institutions are set up when actually support should go to the family?
No, it's absolutely right. It's absolutely right. And if you're on the ground there, you'd know that because you can't just hand money out. It doesn't work like that. I know that somebody might have a theory like that, but what I have found as someone who operates an orphanage and has for 10 years, that the opportunities for education, for food, for nutrition, for caring are not available. And in many cases, it's the parents who are bringing them in, or a mother or a father. The parents aren't together. So, you know, as I said to you, I went to her father and said, are you interested? And he flat out said no.
And do you worry that, whereas your orphanage may well be very well run, there are hundreds of these sorts of institutions in Haiti, many of them not registered. Do you worry that it is a sort of industry that has proliferated?
No, I don't. I think you need to come to Haiti and see what's really going on, because it's easy to judge from however many miles away that, oh, this should be this or this should be that. But on the ground, the people that I meet who are running orphanages are overwhelmingly doing it from love and caring, and because there's no alternative there.
Now, Chika died in 2017. What did you learn from her brief life?
Oh, I learned an awful lot. I learned that it's never too late to start a family. Getting to see how your time changes and your priorities change when you think you've got a life that's all sort of settled in, and you're in your 50s, you say, well, you can't possibly squeeze in anything else. You've got your work life, your social life. And all of a sudden, everything has to melt while you're trying to find a cure for a child, and you're traveling around the world to do it. And it's amazing how you make room for all that. I learned a sense of wonder from her and how tough children really can be, because she was a lot tougher than we were when it came to battling the disease. So it was kind of a 2-year education.
Mitch Albom. The perpetrator of Friday's attack on London Bridge, Usman Khan, killed 2 people and injured several others. To tell us more about him and why, after an 8-year jail term, he was determined to kill again, I have with me Haras Rafiq, a former CEO of the counter-extremism organisation Quilliam and now co-director of Legatum Communications. So, Haras, can you tell us, first of all, how was Usman Khan radicalised?
Usman was initially arrested in 2010, and the reason why he was arrested was that he was being monitored due to his links with the nefarious Anjem Chowdhury and the proscribed Al-Muhajirun group, who are really responsible for the overwhelming majority of Islamist-inspired terrorist attacks in the UK. He was being monitored and he was being recorded, and his house was raided, and they found lots of information, lots of evidence that he was preparing to carry out attacks in London, but also to set up a training camp in Kashmir in Pakistan as well. How he was radicalized really was believing in a version of Islam that believes that that version, we call it Salafi jihadism, we call it Islamism, and we can talk more about that, but really that type of Islam believes that that is the only true version of Islam, and that everybody else is a kafir, a disbeliever, and that they have to set up an Islamist state.
And now he was imprisoned. He was only 19. What went on in prison? I mean, he was supposed to be joining various de-radicalization programs, wasn't he? Which he did do. What do you think happened?
Well, I think it's very easy for people to join and take part in these de-radicalization programs to try to limit their sentence or to try to get out early and say the right things, especially if you know what you're doing. And sometimes the quality of the individual mentor, the intervention provider, may not be the best. Sometimes, you know, it's all down to human individuality, and some people are better at it than others. So it's quite possible that he led them along and tried to get his sentence reduced and tried to get out. The sentence initially, he was actually in an indeterminate sentence in 2012, which means that the release would be after a very, very long time, and he would only be released once the parole board thought that he was no longer a threat to society. But those types of sentences were quashed by the EU Human Rights Court in 2012, and he had an appeal, and that the judge then said that he should be getting 16 years with an automatic release after 8. And that's what seems to happen in this instance. You know, he was part of a...
Yes, and I suppose it's very hard to know if somebody has taken part in one of these programmes. I mean, he was doing this course, Learning Together, and seemed to become a bit of a poster boy for rehabilitation. It's very hard to know what goes on in someone's heart, isn't it?
in somebody's heart and also what they're planning in their mind as well. And if you look at some of the, it's so sad that the person who was leading the course were trying to rehabilitate him. And you're right, he was a poster boy. He was a case study in one of their brochures and one of their programs. And it's really sad that the person who actually led the course was killed by him. But what herein lies one of the problems. If you don't have the ideological understanding of Islamism and what inspires these people, and you just look at some of the other facts, it's very, very hard to ascertain whether somebody has been de-radicalized and rehabilitated.
And do you think basically that's one of the problems, is that we don't really understand sort of the difference between Islam and Islamism? After all, he would be rejected, wouldn't he, by many Muslims as not being a good Muslim?
Well, first of all, there's no concept within Islam of a practicing Muslim or a good Muslim or a bad Muslim. You either are a Muslim or you're not. And the only way that somebody becomes a Muslim is by saying the testament of faith, the Shahada. Therefore, by this definition, he was a Muslim. But the reality is that within Islam, there are so many different sects, so many different interpretations, just as there are within other religions, within Christianity, within Hinduism, within Judaism, etc. And one of the prevailing views that's actually come through the society within the UK and around the world is Islamism. And Islamism really is a political ideology in the same way that there's a difference between social and socialism. Social is the way that we interact. Socialism is a political ideology that just happens to be left of center. Islam is a religion that's practiced by over a billion people in so many different ways. And Islamism is one of those interpretations, which is a political ideology that wants to set up a utopian Islamist state and enforce a version of Sharia as state law. This is what he believed, and this is what a lot of Muslims, I'm not saying the majority, it's still a minority, a lot of Muslims within the UK and around the world believe as well.
Do you now worry about reprisals against Islamic communities because of this attack, you know, fueling the far right yet again?
I think that one of the things that has become very, very evident over the last few years, over the last 5 to 10 years, is that social media has become the new church. People spend more time on social media than they do if they're Muslim within a mosque or praying, doing their prayers, or in church or in other temples. And people are taking polarized positions. The nuance that we have in the UK is pretty good, that people do understand. The majority of people do understand that there is a difference between certain types of Muslims and certain types of Islam. But that nuance has actually been spread thin, and the polarization to, it's all Muslims or some Muslims, and that's becoming more and more evident.
So how do we bridge that gap? How do we prevent this kind of tribalism developing?
I think that one of the things that we need to do is to treat this ideology that Usman Khan followed and many others do as a political ideology, and treat it in the same way that we treat fascism or in the same way that we treat racism. And we need to do that collectively as a society. And that doesn't mean that it's all the government's responsibility, civil society's responsibility to take that challenge on as well. And at the moment, we have people within the Muslim communities in some in denial, and people without the Muslim communities blaming all Muslims, and that isn't really helpful.
Okay, thank you very much, Haras Rafiq. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, over on Radio 3, a service for Advent with carols comes live from the chapel of St John's College, Cambridge. The service reflects the season of Advent and includes familiar hymns together with new works performed by the world-famous chapel choir. Well, that's it for this week's Sunday. Edward Sturton is in the chair next week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.